That's the great Ben Webster with something called Blue Light that was recorded in Copenhagen in 1965. Oh, hearing all that stuff going on there. Okay. Jeff, are you with us?
Yes. Hi, Therese, and hello to the audience.
Okay. Everyone. I'm glad to hear that you're with us. That's good. Today, well, let's just state the obvious. We are not going to go to Washington, D.C., and to be part or, quote, report on what we already have a clear idea about that is transpiring in Washington, D.C., as the former president, Donald Trump, is being tried on charges of fomenting an insurrection, among other things. But that's the major charge. We have important work to do, and we will continue on our journey, and that is to be talking about this great man, Hubert Harrison, the voice of Harlem radicalism, which we began on Monday. So today is part two of a four-part series on Hubert Henry Harrison, the father of Harlem radicalism. And the presentation will continue on Thursday and Friday. We try to get as much in as possible before the end of this week so that you have the opportunity to ask questions and, of course, to get answers. And we can ask for no better guide than our guest who has written this two-book compendium, which just recently, hot off the presses, it's more than 1,500 pages altogether, but it really gives, even though I'm sure he would say, well, this is the opening salvo, this is not the entire work of Hubert Harrison, but this is the best way to understand him and his contribution to our understanding of our history. And it's a two-book compendium, I call it. It's very comprehensive and fresh off the press. So we are concentrating on these two books as the introduction, an extraordinary introduction to this extraordinary man. So we will take Wednesday and do some other stuff. But on Thursday and Friday, we come back and we finish this week-long presentation. I have the great honor to present to you Dr. Jeffrey B. Perry, who is the author, as I said, of this two-book work. And it's really, it pales when you say it's just two books. I mentioned yesterday that when the UPS guy delivered a box, it was a small enough box, and then followed up by saying, you need some help with that? I couldn't imagine what it is he was talking about. I could handle a small box until I lifted it and realized, yep, you have a point there. Yes, you could help me with it, because it was heavy. Huge books. A lot of information in one place, and it was a pleasure to open up that box and see the man we are going to be talking about for quite some time to come, even after this presentation is over. Yesterday, Jeff Perry chronicled the trajectory of Hubert Henry Harrison's life. Born as he was into poverty in St. Croix, from there to the beginnings of his intellectual and radical consciousness and his public exposure to life, real life in the United States, and what that meant, what he learned from it, and how determined he was to address it. We opened, for example, today with Ben Webster, who had that wonderful piece of music, and he literally felt the need to leave the country and go to live in Denmark because the racism that he had experienced as a musician was so overwhelming, it actually interfered with his creativity and his productivity. Similarly, Harrison was able to look very deeply and analytically at how life is lived in the United States and the apparatus that controlled it, the political, economic, and social apparatus. And so we will proceed with that discussion today as our focus. So thanks again for being with us, Jeff. Great to have you with us again. Are you there?
Would you like me to open? Yes, I'm here. I thought maybe four or five opening quotes from Harrison, and then we could see how you feel and how the audience feels, how you might want to go. One thing I want to stress again, I hope you can hear me. I want to stress again, Harrison was a radical internationalist. He wrote in 1926, "Although I am not satisfied with American conditions as they are now, I realize that in these days of change and unrest, I would not have been satisfied anywhere else. In China, I would be fighting against foreign domination. In Egypt, India, South Africa, or West Africa, I would be fighting against the British oligarchs. In Jamaica, against the sinister repression of black people predicted by both whites, practiced by both whites and mulattoes. And in the Dutch, French, or American West Indies, against crackerism, stupidity, or cowardice." He really is an outstanding internationalist. I should also add that after the first volume came out, I had scholars from India writing to me and saying what Harrison wrote about conditions in India were the best they saw coming out of this country in that period. So I wanted to open with that quote, food for thought, but then I want to go to a couple of others. A quote throughout all his work, let me see if I can find this thing. There was a little piece posted, I don't know if I'm going to be able to find it, by Jenna Sideri. Usman Power Green, after we spoke yesterday, did a review on Stansberry Forum, and he talks about Harrison understood the centrality of the struggle against white supremacy, which is a point I tried to make yesterday. All of his organizations, from when he's with the Socialist Party to when he founds the it's a struggle against white supremacy and for equality. He thinks that's the key. When he's with the Socialist Party, he advocates such policies. When he founds the New Negro Movement in 1917, he does. And all the way through to his last organization, the International Colored Unity League. Now, why does Harrison consider this so important? There's a quote from a fellow named Theodore W. Allen, who I also write about. And Allen writes, let me just find the quote here. Here it is. Allen writes, regarding the United States, "The most vulnerable point at which a decisive blow can be struck against bourgeois rule in the United States is white supremacy." And Allen's a staunch class radical, but he writes that. And he goes on to say, "White supremacy is both the keystone and the Achilles heel of U.S. bourgeois democracy, the historic font of bourgeois rule in the U.S. So Allen understands this the nature of this white supremacy. It's what the ruling class relies on, but it's what we can and have to beat them on, you know, if we want to really make progress. And Harrison understood that, and I think that's reflected in his works. Now, another opening quote I just wanted to go to. Let me see. I was, unfortunately, my computer went down the other day. So just bear with me for a second. Okay. Let's see. Well, not finding the one I want. But Harrison was an autodidact. Now, I think that I want to stress the importance of that, because that also gets into a bit why he's in some ways so perceptive of what he's up against. And a book was written, and it talks about autodidacts, if I can find it. I can't find it right now, but the author, who's a sociologist, writes that sometimes the autodidact has the ability to perceive and understand conditions in their period better than those who are mired in the academy and the traditional paths of passing along intellectual thought. And I think that was the case with Harrison. He again, lots of quotes are available, but he struggled throughout his life to just address problems. He wanted to focus, his phrase, with my eyes wide open. He wanted to address social issues and deal with them. And I thought I had this all ready for you before I got here. The radical internationalism. I also want to, at one point, I think it would be good to focus on how history is written. And I mentioned that a little bit yesterday, but I have some key examples that we can talk about. And I also want to, I think it would be important to talk about how he differs from those major leaders of his lifetime, Booker T. Washington, W.E.B. Du Bois, and Marcus Garvey. Particularly in the second volume, I get into his differences with Du Bois and Garvey, and they center around this question of equality, because during World War I, Du Bois was willing to forego demands for equality and the demands for enforcement of 13th, 14th, and 15th Amendment to support Woodrow Wilson's war effort. And Garvey, on the other hand, rather than fight those struggles, was looking to maybe go to Africa, or he was preaching that anyway. And Harrison constantly said, no, our struggle is here, and here's where we have to fight it. So I wanted to open with some of those thoughts. And as we go on, I might find the quotes I wanted to use. But again, and it comes back to his quote about that he wrote in 1912, that politically the Negro is the touchstone of the modern democratic idea. The presence of the Negro puts our democracy to the proof and reveals the falsity of it. True democracy and equality implies a revolution startling to even think of. He thought this was unquestionably the key, the struggle for equality for African Americans. And that's very different, again, in many organizations on the left, for instance, who will put forth their list of demands and their programmatic approach, and they'll say, well, we stand for this, 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 and that, and down number seven is racial equality, this or that. And Harrison was not of that sort. He said, no, this is key and this is central. This is the task we have to focus on and take them on. And he was clear in so doing. It was in not only the interest of African Americans, but it was in the interest of laboring class European Americans, because he thought that the ruling class, you know, tried to foster white supremacy to maintain their social control. So that's some opening comments, if you or anyone else wants to say anything.
Okay. Well, in fact, it's a good time for me to make a little announcement. that if you have a question that you'd like to pose to Jeff Perry, you can do so at 888-874-4888. Please be sure you have a question, not an essay. Okay. So, Jeff, what was the period in which you would say, having written this book, all 1,588 pages of the compendium, what did you notice was a trigger for Harrison's aggression on this question? What preceded it, or what caused it?
Well, he came from St. Croix, as we discussed, and I've got some wonderful quotes here also, which I don't know if I'll find right now, but they're in the books, about growing up in St. Croix and thinking he was essentially the equal of any other person. A remarkable statement, you know, when you think about it, at least people in the U.S. think about it, because he's very dark-skinned and he's very poor, but he thought he was the equal of anyone else. And when he comes to the U.S., the phrase he uses is he was shocked by the racism he encountered. And other Afro-Caribbeans, Marcus Garvey, comments similarly, as does Claude McKay, who says something to the effect of, I had heard about racism in the U.S., but I never dreamed of it being so brutal and vicious. And so early on, he was made hit in the face, if you will, with the white supremacy of the U.S. And as he started to get radical and moved towards socialism, because he was an internationalist of spirit, he was for the downtrodden, the poor, and the working people. And as he started doing work with the socialists, he tried to appeal within the Socialist Party early. There were two big factions, those who wanted to seek change through revolutionary means, you know, mass strikes and militant, struggles directly challenging the system, and those who wanted to take a more evolutionary approach through elections and politics and things like that. And he pointed out to the socialists that in each case, the socialists needed, he was using the phrase of the day, Negroes, right? Because they needed the Negro votes and they needed the Negro support if they wanted to have militant workplace struggles and things like that. So he was very clear on the centrality of Black involvement in any significant efforts for social change. And he, as he goes on and he writes his first early pieces for the socialists, again, he's emphasizing that the crucial test for the socialists is, he phrases it, socialism or Southernism. And he does this a year before Du Bois. Du Bois attracts a lot of attention when he makes similar comments, but Harrison precedes even Du Bois on this, although he's younger than Du Bois. And Harrison is pushing this, but he gets a very poor response from the socialists. And he then, after he continues struggling, you know, he's very active during the Debs campaign, the Patterson strike, and other things. But when he finally decides to leave the Socialist Party, it's because he thinks that they put the leaders and the labor movement put the white race first before class. Very important to remember that. So then he decides, you know, that he's going to work to build a new race-conscious movement in the face of this white supremacy. It would be race-conscious, and it would struggle for racial solidarity and race consciousness and racial equality to counter the white supremacy that he was facing in society. And he was very popular. This, people may think he's just an intellectual, but he was speaking on street corners. He was writing. He had walked down the streets in Harlem, and the kids loved everybody. You know, he was very popular, and he lived on the most densely populated block in Harlem. And he had quite a good following. And when he founds that Liberty League, his first organization in 1917, it's pushing those demands for political equality and justice and equal opportunity enforcement of 13th, 14th, and 15th Amendments. And it attracts quite a large grouping, relative, of course, of the leading activists and militants in Harlem to his organization and his newspaper, The Voice, including Garvey. And he continues with that struggle. But now certain things come up along the way, one of which is he's always in poverty. He winds up having five children. He has four children and his wife when he founds the Liberty League. And funding is always a problem, but he's very principled for the most part about it. And when a white donor wants to, as I mentioned yesterday, donate $10,000, he says, no, I want to keep this. We're going to do this and direct this ourselves. And so Garvey, by late 1919, starts a spurt of growth, again, after assassination attempt on Garvey's life and with the sale of Black Star Line and Liberian Construction Loan funds. He asked Harrison to come and work for him. Now, Harrison, by that time, is both the leading orator in Harlem, and he had pioneered that tradition that was followed by Randolph and Owen and Garvey and much later Malcolm X. And he's the leading journalist. So he's an extraordinary combination. And that's the two main ways you reach the masses back then. This is pre-TV, pre-radio. Radio's not even kicking in until the 20s, right? And so he is quite, you know, and he's got the clarity of vision. And so he comes and he impacts the Negro world immediately. And it's one of the truly outstanding chapters in the history of Black journalism. And I think you, with your background, and others, as you read that, you'll find it so fascinating how he analyzes what the situation is at the Negro world and how he lays forth the steps that he will take to improve it and change it and carry on the message. But by late 1920, after the second Congress of the Garvey movement, he's very disenchanted with Garvey. And although he stays on for another year as a contributing editor, he's no longer having his final say on what's going on. He declines running for an office at the convention in 1920. And he basically starts setting out on his course of independent journal and lecturing, which for the most part is what he did for the last number of years of his life.
Well, we have a couple of questions lined up for you. Marcus from Madison, you're on the air with Jeff Perry.
First of all, thank you, Ms. Leib, for putting this really edifying program on the air. And Professor Perry, I look forward to devouring your new work as quickly as possible. My question is this. I'll be brief as I want to hear you continue to discourse on this. One of the things that always struck me about Harrison is how free he is of narrow sectarianism, which was unfortunately a real stumbling block for many thinkers at that time on the left. And he was contemporaneous to another figure for, as far as I can tell from the dates, about at least 30 years. And I was wondering if you could tell me if Mr. Harrison had thoughts on Lucy Parson, whose milieu was Chicago and Harrison's was New York, but they were both striking figures of internationalism in different ways. And I was wondering if you could tell me if there was any relationship intellectually or otherwise, and if he had thoughts on her.
Well, thank you. Very good question. Very good. And by the way, last week I was on WORT out there in Madison. Alan Ruff had a show for about an hour on Harrison. You might want to look for that, too. You said you're from Wisconsin, right?
I am. I'm in Madison.
Yeah, yes. So you might find that of interest. But regarding Lucy Parsons, I don't recall him having any contact. He did go to Chicago in the 20s, and he stayed for a while, both delivering some talks and even went to, the corner where a lot of the soapbox orators would speak there near the Newberry Library. I think I can't recall the name right now. But he, I don't recall Lucy Parsons at all. And your first question, forgive me, before Lucy Parsons, you had raised a question?
Well, the reason I asked was because they both seemed to be so free of narrow sectarianism and were internationalists.
Yes. Yeah. And I think that's true of Harrison, although some people, you know, mistook his criticisms for being spiteful or anything like that. But as I tried to explain yesterday, and I'll just briefly repeat, Harrison was reared in a wonderful intellectual climate in New York that was set up and maintained by black working class intellectuals. They were lyceums. One of the main places was at the Church of St. Benedict the Moor, Roman Catholic Church on 53rd Street. This is before the IRT goes up to Harlem. And Schomburg was involved with it, Johnny Bruce, and the Burroughs, the two Burroughs people who would later, their son would be responsible, partly responsible with his wife for the founding of DuSable Museum in Chicago. And the atmosphere in these lyceums was wonderful. It was African-Americans and Afro-Caribbeans coming together, because there was early tension in the early 20th century, but they would discuss all types of topics, current events, historical events, political events, and they would express their views openly and critically. And afterwards, they could still go out and have a bite to eat or something like this. It's the type of atmosphere I think is much needed to this day. I mean, I grew up in the 60s and 70s, and it wasn't always like that. And Harrison maintained that, and he, throughout his life, he would criticize many prominent people openly, but it wasn't mean-spirited. He was taking on issues, but a lot of people didn't handle that very well. For instance, during World War I, and I don't know how much I got into this yesterday, but during World War I, when Woodrow Wilson was leading the U.S. into World War I, two supporters of Wilson's efforts were Joel E. Spingarn, who was the head of the NAACP, and who to this day the NAACP gives their award for outstanding achievement by a black American in his name, and he was the closest white friend of Du Bois. Joel Spingarn was a major in military intelligence, the branch of the government that monitored the black and the radical community. Jump ahead 50 years or so, and you've got COINTELPRO. I mean, it's that type of relationship. And he's the closest friend to Du Bois, and he doesn't want opposition to Wilson's effort. But Harrison and William Monroe Trotter plan a Liberty Congress in 1918 to demand enforcement of the 13th, 14th, and 15th Amendment and federal anti-lynching legislation. The NAACP at this time was not advocating federal anti-lynching legislation. That's a fact that may surprise many listeners, because they associate the NAACP with federal anti-lynching, but they were not supporting it in 1918, nor for a number of years still to come, because they didn't want to alienate Southern white support. And Spingarn was the head of that organization when the war was going on. But then there's the question of Du Bois, who is Du Bois says that Spingarn was his closest white friend. And in fact, Spingarn would oftentimes help Du Bois financially, personally, as well as what he got through the organization. And in 1918, as Wilson's going to war, Du Bois writes the editorial he's most embarrassed about in his entire life. And it's entitled Close Ranks. It's only one paragraph long. And I actually discussed it in both volumes, because it's how I end volume one and begin volume two. And in that paragraph, he says, "While this war lasts, let us forget our special grievances And then he goes on to essentially say, and close ranks behind Woodrow Wilson's war efforts. Now, Harrison knew, as did many of his Du Bois's careful readers, that Du Bois had even described what the grievances were about two or three issues earlier in the Crisis magazine, but they were lynching, segregation, disfranchisement. And Harrison took Du Bois to task for that, and he openly criticized him in his paper, The Voice, after which, essentially, Du Bois would never speak to Harrison again, never have any real communication with him again. And so...
I want to move on. We have quite a few people waiting to talk to you.
Okay, I'm sorry. I'm sorry.
No, I'm sorry, too, because you want to give such a comprehensive answer, but
okay,
I want to clock.
Treece, you're good at this. I can't catch your visual cues. I don't see you. I'm sorry.
I know.
Interrupt whenever you want, please.
Okay. We're going along just fine. David from Brooklyn, you're on the air for Jeff.
Good afternoon, Jeff. This is David from Brooklyn.
How are you doing?
I have one laser question I want to get to you. I want to know if Harrison at some time had a plan of how to deal with the masses of so-called white people that are under control of the ruling class that runs the country, and how this could be dealt with in terms of getting them to understand that the concept of white supremacy is one that is that's instituted for the benefit of the ruling class and the divide and conquer strategy. So I'd appreciate if you'd approach that question.
I'll be brief, and it's an excellent question. And he did when he was with the socialists, and his plan was for the Socialist Party to make the struggle against white supremacy central to their program and to their work. But the Socialist Party did not do it. And that's what eventually led to his leaving the party. He had laid it before them, to them, 1912 convention. He says, Southernism or socialism? What's going to be the direction of this party? And they responded by not even discussing the Negro question, at the 1912 convention. So that was the core of his approach. You know, he said, let's take it head on. After which, when he was rebuffed by the socialists and later by the labor movement, he says, well, we can't wait. We can't wait around. Black people have to come together, and we have to, you know, unite and struggle for racial equality, develop a racial consciousness in the face of this white supremacy. And in brief, that was his approach.
Thank you, David, for your question. Ed from Queens, you're on the air with Jeff Perry.
Hello.
Hello.
Yeah, can you hear me? Hello, how you doing?
Yes. Okay.
Ed, good afternoon, Professor Perry. I appreciate your participation in this program. I had two questions specifically about Hubert Henry Hunter Harrison. Number one, would you consider him to be an atheist? Based on his approach to religion and his, from what I've read, his dismissal of it as far as it's pertaining to the struggle of African Americans. And what was the main basis for his dispute with Booker T. Washington? Was it just the subservience of the cash or buckets where they lay, the lack of the want to be accepted by white society? He's more of a resistance and a militant, according to what I've read about him, as far as him being called a Black Socrates and his advanced views on race and class. So those are basically my two questions. Thank you.
Thank you very much. And good questions. And again, you'll find the answers in the books, in Harrison's own words, far better than I'm going to put them forth now. But at various points, he referred to himself as an atheist or an agnostic. I describe this in the books, and he understands the distinction between the two, but he seems to go back and forth. But he was pretty firmly a critic of Christianity, the philosophy and the religion, and particularly the role it played in Africa. In the current issue of the Truth Seeker, which is a free thought magazine, the January to April issue, I have a rather long article on Harrison's views on Christianity in Africa. But he also was critical of Christianity's role in the United States in opposing abolitionists and supporting, you know, slavery in various ways. So he was an atheist or an agnostic, and he used the each phrase at times to describe himself. Regarding the dispute with Booker T. Washington, he starts out when he's young, and he considers himself, if you will, Du Bois man. The big controversy was between Du Bois and Booker T., and Du Bois was challenging Booker T. on a number of issues, basically that he was too conservative. And along those lines, Harrison kept scrapbooks, and this is very fascinating. And they're available now because I've placed them at Columbia University, over 40 scrapbooks in which this is how he had files today. Today we have, back then, today we have electronic files, but he would put newspaper clippings in old magazines and paste them in. And a couple of them were on subservience. I hope you can hear that. And the one on subservience featured prominently Booker T. Washington, and he considered Booker T. Washington a subservient. As a matter of fact, in the books, I have a quote from Booker T., which says, I believe he says of one of the presidents, I think it's Theodore Roosevelt, he goes, "Anything he wants done, I will do." And so Harrison just didn't agree with that approach at all. He was too independent thinking. And then what really triggered everything was when Booker T. goes to Europe in late 1910, and he issues some statements that conditions are basically fine back in the U.S. Du Bois gets together a group of over 50 people and issues protests. Harrison writes two letters to the New York Sun, a daily newspaper, saying essentially, Booker T., you are free to say what you want, but you should tell the truth. And then Booker T. uses his Tuskegee machine, which involves Emmett Scott, his right-hand person, and Morgan, who's the postmaster in New York. And they have Harrison summarily fired from the post office after 4 years, has a totally clean record. I'm a postal worker for 33 years. I know how to get access to his records. And his record was clean. And in the Booker T. Washington papers, you can see there's a correspondence between Booker T. and Scott. We say, we took care of that guy, you know. So they were some of his differences with Booker T.
Wow. A little bit of gangsterism going on there. Henry from Chicago, you're on the air with Jeff Perry.
How you doing, Yatrice?
Okay, thank you. How are you?
All right, and greetings, Dr. Perry. Thank you for this presentation and the work you're doing on Hubert Harrison. You mentioned that Hubert Harrison was a book reviewer. Now, one of the more interesting books that was written during Hubert Harrison's time is The Rising Tide of Color by Lopper Stoddard. I always said, you know, it's not a lot of
speak,
truth.
Speak louder. Can you get closer?
Hello?
I'm not hearing all your words. Please speak louder. We'll get close to your mic.
Hello?
Oh, yes. Go on. I'm sorry.
Oh, okay. Well, I was wondering if Hubert Harrison did a book review on Lopper Stoddard's book, The Rising Tide of Color. I always consider that if you want to get into a mind of a white supremacist, that would be the book to read. And I know Lopper Stoddard also debated W.E.B. Du Bois, but I wonder if Hubert Harrison ever looked or reviewed Lopper Stoddard's work.
Yes. In answer to your question, he wrote several. One second, this other phone is ringing. Hold on. I'm so sorry.
I'm laughing at you because you're supposed to have this thing down pat.
Yeah, I'm reaching every which. Oh, my gosh. I truly apologize.
Not at all. Not at all, really. This is life.
Okay, I'm going to just speak over it. Yes, Harrison wrote several reviews of Stoddard's Rising Tide of Color. He even had some correspondence with Stoddard, which is discussed in Volume 2. And Stoddard thought that Harrison's review of his book was one of the more interesting ones that he read. But Harrison also pointed out that a number of the points that Stoddard made in relation to the rising tide of color, if you will, that Harrison had been articulating since 1915 and the like. But Stoddard's book, of course, Harrison wasn't getting much play, and Stoddard's book swept the country, you know, with interest around 1920. But now some comments by Harrison on Stoddard can be found both in a Hubert Harrison Reader. I believe I have reviews of two of Harrison's reviews of Stoddard, and also discussion in detail in Volume 2, The Struggle for Equality. But he also talks about other Stoddard books, too, in terms of Islam. Stoddard writes later in the 1920s about Islam and Pan-African revolt and things like that. And Harrison reviews that stuff. So if you're interested in what was Harrison's response to Stoddard's works, I think you'll find much of interest, particularly in Volume 2 and in the links in Volume 2, because I link to a lot of key related pieces.
Thanks, Henry. Leona from Michigan, you're on the air with Jeff Perry.
Greetings, Utrice. Greetings,
thank you,
Mr. Perry. Listen, I got two quick questions, if you don't mind. But first, I just want to make a quick comment. Booker T. Washington, although he was considered a big leader with Negro people, whatever, in 1911, he was assaulted by a white man in New York, beaten all up and down the street for whatever that word. My point is, he was still subject to the system of racism, white supremacy, Booker T. Washington. But Dr. Perry, I wanted to ask you, earlier in the conversation, you mentioned something about, and I may have heard you wrong, but first of all, thank you for your work, where you mentioned that Hubert Harrison was a dark-skinned man who believed that he was, for lack of a better word, second to none. My question to you is, do you find that unusual?
Well, I can't get into minds of everybody, but it's certainly not what is breaded into people in the U.S. so much.
I'm having a little trouble hearing you.
It had a lot to do with conditions down in St. Croix, where social control is in a different fashion than in the U.S. And Harrison felt, however, he writes some places that as a dark-skinned man, he couldn't get a job on any of the black newspapers but one. I think he was referring to the Negro World. He also speaks about discrimination within race discrimination at various points, and he, in relation to the NAACP and Du Bois, and he advocates that the talented 10th should come down from near Mount Sinai and get amongst the people. Regarding the Booker T. Washington assault, I have a little bit about that in Volume 1, and you might find it of interest, you know?
Leona?
Yeah, can you hear me? Hello?
Yeah, did you hear what I said?
Yes, sir. Can you? Yeah, and I do have a copy of your book, the first volume. I haven't finished, you know, reading it yet. But my second question, right quick, is regarding the writing of history. I find it somewhat interesting that that people classified as white scholars seem to be doing a good amount of work on writing about people classified as black. And I'm curious about how history is written. You said you're going to touch on that at some point, so I'm curious to know how is history written. And it seems like, because Lerone Bennett back in 1976 remarked about how this, you know, it seems to be a lot of funding going into getting behind white scholars writing about black history. I don't understand it all, but can you speak to that a little bit about how history is written?
Yeah, and I want to talk in terms of Harrison in particular. We can get into a much deeper talk on this. I've mentioned at various points I was deeply influenced by Theodore W. Allen, who's the author of The Invention of the White Race and pioneered class struggle, white skin privilege analysis. And in the beginning of his book, he writes, and he's in his 70s by this time, in the beginning of his Invention of the White Race, he goes, "It took me a long time to say that I am not white." And Allen constantly struggled against white throughout his whole life. And I see nothing progressive in white identity, so I try and challenge it constantly, white identity. But I understand what you're asking. Now, regarding how history is written, I understand some of what the factors might be. That's why if you read my introduction to Volume 2, you will see that what I tried to do is I tried to let Harrison speak rather than me, right? And that's why it's quoted so precisely and abundantly. I didn't set out to write on Harrison, but things developed as they did, and I just kept working on it, as well as I did many other things. I was very active in the labor movement for 30 years, and I put out a few volumes on Theodore W. Allen's work. But on how history is written, if I can find the quotes, once again, I have in one of my books, and this is in the book for Diasporic Africa Press I did, and I talk about what goes on is, and one good example, if you will, concerns the subject of the new Negro. Harrison, for the most part, has been ignored for years in terms of discussion of the new Negro, despite the fact that he's founder of the first organization and the first newspaper of the new Negro movement, The Voice and the Liberty League, despite the fact that he edits the New Negro Monthly in 1919, a journal of the international consciousness of the Negro, an international consciousness of the, I forget what the rest of the subtitle is, of the Negro people, or the colored people, colored world, that in 1920, he writes, "When Africa Awakes, the Inside Story of the New Negro in the Western World." So he's written 50, 75, 100 articles related to the militant New Negro movement, yet he's ignored so much. When Alain Locke's book comes out in 1925, although Harrison was supposed to had something that was supposed to be being considered as a contribution to that publication, it was pulled by the authorities, the powers that be. One historian says because it was too radical. And I have this comment, which might take about 2 or 3 minutes to read, if Utrice, if you think it's okay, and if Leona wants to hear it.
Sure.
And it's a, okay.
Yes, we are close to the clock, but we can do it.
Okay, and here we go on this. Please stay with me. It's print looks small as I get older. Though Harrison's contributions to the new Negro movement are well documented, they have often been ignored or presented in a manner that removes from view his seminal role. For example, Dr. Henry Louis Gates, Jr. makes no mention of Harrison in his major article, The Trope of a New Negro and the Reconstruction of the Black, and that was written in 1988. I have the full citation there. Or in his book, Life Upon These Shores, Looking at African-American History, which came out in 2011, which he said seeks to look at the full sweep of African-American history. A publication by Gates entitled The New Negro, Readings on Race, Representation, and African-American Culture, edited by Gates and Jean Andrew Jarrett, reprints a number of Harrison articles without including acknowledgement of their sources And seven, I won't even go into the specifics, seven of the 10 articles are misdated, in which the primacy of Harrison's articles is lost because they're dated. They're suggested that they're written in 1922 when they're written in 1920, or they're listed as 1920 when they're written in 1917. So that's one example of how that goes on. But and then he also goes on in that book to say that Harrison was politicized during World War I to a militant stance because of Du Bois's militant stance, because of Du Bois's, and I quote, political warrior mentality related to the war. And in fact, Harrison was the leading critic of Du Bois during the war, and he was the leading critic of the Close Ranks editorial, which, by the way, if I didn't mention it yesterday, years later, Du Bois acknowledged that his critics of his position in World War I were correct. But I can even go further in terms of this.
I don't think so, because we're running out of time.
Yeah. Thank you for that, Eutresa. Thank you, Dr. Perry. And just for the record, right quick, I know we're down to the wire here. In the Detroit area, some people refer to Henry Louis Gates as Henry Skip the Truth Gates, for whatever that's worth. And I appreciate your effort to try to link back to the sources, Dr. Perry. I'm out, Eutresa. Thank you.
You got to talk to. Send me an email.
Thank you very much. We don't have time, so we'll have to wrap it up here, but that doesn't mean we just nixed a conversation that was probably going to happen anyway. We will come back to that. As I said, we will return to the program on Thursday and Friday. So we continue with Jeff Perry on those 2 days. I thank you very much for your very thoughtful questions. And Jeff, as usual, I thank you for having an ironclad memory. you can spit out these dates like nothing. So thank you so much for being with us these 2 days. And I look forward to us coming back together again on Thursday and Friday to finish up on the subject of Hubert Harrison. But it's been
thank you so,
so
much, Eutresa, too, and thanks to the audience and to the people who contributed questions and things like that. I really appreciate.
Thanks a lot. As you could tell, history is really important here, as it was with the paper that I edited for quite a few years. It was a history-centered paper, and I have a love, a natural love for history, and I'm finding that more and more people are interested in history. So we'll see each other again on Thursday on the phone. Thanks so much.
Thank you. Bye-bye.